Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 7th of February. Just before we get rolling on space and an incredible discovery, we want to let you know, we have a Facebook page, and we did have a listener who posted a YouTube link to Al Jazeera's English channel. We were talking about that a lot last hour, so there it is. And if you want to go to our Facebook page, you can leave comments there too. And Chrissy and Rhonda post links on that as well. And we talk, and it's all good. So here's how you get to it. You just go to the Kathleen Dunn Show, and there we are. This hour of the program, I just think that this is just remarkable what has happened, and our guests have played such a key role in making this happen. You were aware that NASA last week, the Kepler mission, discovered its first Earth-sized planet candidates and its first candidates in the habitable zone, a region where liquid water could exist on a planet's surface. Five of the potential planets are near the size of Earth and orbit in the habitable zone of smaller, cooler stars than our sun. Now we need follow-up observations to verify that they are actual planets. We have two guests with us this hour. Professor Sarah Seeger is joining us, the first part of the program. Ellen Swallows Richards, professor of planetary science and professor of physics at MIT, also a member of NASA's Kepler science team. She is the winner of the 2007 American Astronomical Society's Helen B. Warner Prize, and her research focuses on theoretical models of atmospheres and interiors of all kinds of exoplanets. She has a great story to tell about how she became interested in the stars, a visit with her father to, a star party. We'll talk about that. And later in the hour, we welcome Bill Nye, the science guy, who, of course, has been with us before, a man of many, many talents. He's an engineer and a comedian, an author and educator, inventor, Emmy Award-winning television writer, producer, and also vice president of the Planetary Society. We're welcoming phone calls for all of our guests. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Professor Seeger, thank you so much for being with us.
Kathleen, it's great to be online today.
Yeah, great to have you here. Well, this was a huge, huge discovery, wasn't it? And I want to go back for a while because you've been studying exoplanets for quite some time and are quite an expert in this area. But people, I think, probably in the not-too-distant past thought we were talking science fiction here.
Well, in a way, we're talking about the very beginnings of science fiction. We're not going to be able to travel to any of Kepler's planets, but we are going to be able to study those planets and others remotely. But I think we should back up, actually, and talk about the overall goal of the Kepler mission.
Yeah, please.
Well, Kepler is just starting. What they have announced is really just the very tip of the iceberg.
Ooh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Kepler is trying to answer the ancient question, how common are other Earths? How common are Earth-sized planets in our galaxy? And on its way to doing that, Kepler has made the announcement last week of a bunch of really interesting new things.
How common are other Earths? And tell me about the mission itself. It's a telescope. Is it one large telescope, or is there something out in space looking as well?
Kepler is one telescope.
One telescope.
Mm-hmm. It's in space. And most of the listeners will be familiar with the Hubble Space Telescope.
Right.
So if you think of Hubble, Kepler is like a very specialized version of a space telescope. It's the first space telescope purposely designed to find other planets. And it's in a very different orbit. It's a smaller telescope than the Hubble Space Telescope. And unlike Hubble, which looks at so many different astronomical objects, Kepler only looks at one field of the sky every 6 seconds for years.
And what field is that?
It's a part of the sky in the constellation of Cygnus, the Swan.
Mm-hmm.
But the goal is to monitor stars continuously, looking for a little tiny drop in brightness of a star that's characteristic of a planet going in front of the star as seen from Earth. And because it's such a rare event, Kepler must look at 150,000 sun-like stars.
Oh, my goodness.
Just to answer the question, how common are other Earths?
And why was that particular part of the sky chosen?
Well, there's a number of different reasons, but one is you want enough stars, but not too many, so the field is so crowded that they blend together.
And you're looking at stars that are how far away, these images that came back?
Well, these stars are between about 500 and 2,000 light years away.
Wow. So it'd be kind of hard to get there.
In fact, you know what? It would be hard to get to any star, even if it's the nearest star. Right now, we don't have any way to even get to the nearest star.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't have to worry, because we have a lot of ways. You know, astronomy, the history of astronomy for 400 years since the telescope was invented, we have ways of learning things from very far away.
Hmm. And so now we go through some kind of procedure, and tell me what it is and how elaborate it is to confirm that these are planets.
Okay, well, I'm really, really glad you brought this up, because most of the 1,200 objects announced by Kepler are just planet candidates. They're not 100% sure planets. Now, going from planet candidate to planet is extremely difficult. One of the past Kepler objects, we could estimate it took 1,000 people hours to go from planet candidate to actual planet. And this really just involves in making sure it's not a false positive. Hmm. That's like, you know, you go to the doctor, you get a test. They want to make sure that they tell you the right answer, not the wrong answer.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, there's many complicated steps to doing that. I can go into them if you think people are interested.
No, we'll wait and see if they are.
Okay, yeah.
If somebody's interested, call and say.
The bottom line is that most of them will never become planets. Most of them will remain planet candidates.
I see.
They won't all be verified as planets. But, however, that's okay, because Kepler's trying to answer the question, how common are Earth-sized planets? Not, does that star have an Earth? Does that one? Does that one? Does that one? So it's
right.
Two very different questions.
And the mission science principal investigator said that the fact that we found so many planet candidates in such a tiny fraction of the sky suggests there are countless planets orbiting sun-like stars in our galaxy. Countless planets.
Exactly. Countless. I mean, our galaxy alone has 100 billion stars. And we believe that in the universe, there are over 100 billion galaxies, so we literally couldn't even count how many planets we think are out there. Moreover, every single star that people observe, every single young star, and we aren't able to watch stars age because they take millions to billions of years, but every star that is born has a disk of gas and dust around it, which will inevitably form planets.
Hmm.
So what we're trying to do is really just understand what kind of planets, what are their orbits like, what are their characteristics. We have no doubt that there are many, many, countless Earth-like planets out there.
Mm-hmm. And what does it mean when the discovery was announced that they had discovered the first Earth-sized planet candidates and the first candidates in the habitable zone? What's the habitable zone?
Well, the habitable zone is a region around the star where astronomers think life could exist. But let me back up a little bit, because all life on Earth requires liquid water. And so it's a natural, although we would say terracentric, like a self-centered view, that life anywhere else needs liquid water. But planets are heated by the star, and so we need to find a planet that is not too cold, not too hot, but just right. And that planet, because it's heated by the star, that means it can't be too far from the star or too close to the star. It has to be just the right distance.
Mm-hmm.
So we call the habitable zone just that right distance from the star.
And indications are that there are how many planets that fit that bill that we've been able to see with Kepler?
I mean, Kepler has found a few, five, but we're not sure if those are all planets. They're just planet candidates now. I mean, the reality
right.
is that we will have to wait until Kepler completes its mission to really give us the full answer to this question.
And how long is that mission? What's Kepler doing right now?
The mission is actually 3.5 years, and it started around May or June 2009. Now, here's why it's 3.5 years. Our Earth takes 1 year to go around the sun. That's the definition of a year. And if we want to find planets Earth size and Earth-like orbits, those will take 1 year to go around. So each year we will see a signal that indicates the planet is going in front of the star as seen from Earth. But we'll see it one time, but we'll have to see it a second time to understand how long their year is, and a third time to confirm. So we need to see three so-called transits of the distant Earth-sized planet around the sun-like star in the Earth-like orbit. We'll have to see it three times, and that's where the 3.5 years comes from.
Mm-hmm. Why is there only, maybe it's because it's expensive or there aren't enough people to look at all the data, considering the vastness of the universe and the fact that this major discovery has taken place, but you're just looking at one tiny part of the sky, imagine all the other parts of the sky that may have something else just like this. Why don't we have more telescopes up there looking at it?
That's a great question, Kathleen, and it really is just two things. One, as you say, resources, and two, you really just do what you need. I mean, think of all the news surveys, they don't pull every single American. They pull what fraction they think they need to get the right answer. So, in fact, Kepler is just looking at a part of the sky that they think is enough. They're looking at enough stars to answer the question, how common are Earth-like planets in our galaxy?
Mm-hmm.
So we don't really need to look at the whole sky to answer that question.
I see.
You better believe that when Kepler comes back with the number, we'll be trying to do the next step based on what Kepler finds.
Yeah. Isn't it amazing that this telescope can be out there? It must be incredibly sophisticated. It's giving us this kind of data. That just dumbfounds me.
It is incredibly sophisticated. I mean, Kepler measures brightness changes in the star with time, really at the level of tens of parts per million. It's really, really exquisite.
Yeah, I imagine. I want to hear about your background a little, because I was interested. You went to a star party with your father to see the moon through a telescope and said to yourself, although your dad had other thoughts, this is it for me. I want to do this.
Well, it didn't really quite work that way. I mean, my father did expose me to many different things, trying to just broaden my horizons. But I do remember the moon as one of my first memories. It just was astounding. And later on, when I was a little bit older, on my first camping trip, walking outside in the dark, dark sky, and looking up in the middle of the night, I just couldn't believe how many stars. I mean, I was just shocked. If I was old enough to have a heart attack, I would have had a heart attack. It was unbelievable. And then later on, when I went to college, I was studying physics because I thought that everything could be described by physics. And in the end, that wasn't true. But I always had this passion for the stars. And I'm so thrilled that I'm able to do this for my job.
Yeah, I would imagine. There can't be anything much more exciting than this. We're going to welcome phone calls, and let me give you our number because we'll start taking them right away. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We're talking about the major announcement from NASA about the Kepler mission and what they have discovered, potential candidates to be planets. And they're just looking at this tiny portion of the sky, and some of those may indeed be habitable. If you find this in that one little part of the sky, what does it say about the rest of the sky? Something. We have a couple lines open, one line open for you if you'd like to join our conversation. And here's how you reach us. Again, 800-486-8655. Professor Sarah Seeger is with us, professor of planetary science and physics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And she is a member of NASA's Kepler science team. Let's start our calls with Scott from La Crosse. Hi, Scott.
Hi there, Kathleen.
Hi.
Long-time listener, long-time caller.
Yeah, I haven't talked to you in a while.
Well, here I am.
There
so
you are.
What I'd like, and before I get started on my question, every time you do one of these shows, somebody gives a shout-out, and I want to be the one to give the shout-out, to Astronomy Picture of the Day website.
Oh, yes, yes. Okay.
It is so great. It is the Green Bay Packers of astronomy sites, I would like to say. Now, my question is, I heard recently, at least it was news to me, that astronomers say that there are no new galaxies being formed. All the galaxies that we'll ever have are already out there. And my question, it's actually two questions. How do they know? And if it's true, why is it not possible that in these clusters of stars and the, you know, all these nebula hatcheries, new galaxy couldn't form?
Okay, that's a really good question, although not totally related to exoplanets. I'm happy to answer it. You know, we astronomers have telescopes, all kinds of telescopes at different wavelengths, and look at our local universe, and they just don't see any galaxies forming. So it's just simply a matter of observation. We don't see any galaxies forming here. We don't see any forming far away. And then we just extrapolate to the rest of the universe. The second part of the question was, why can't they form? I mean, the seeds for galaxy formation just happened very, very, very early on. And there just is no mechanism, no kind of galaxy nursery that we know of, no thing we can think of where they could form today.
Thank you, Scott. It's always nice to hear from you again. You did very, very early work. Tell me more about this in exoplanets. And I have read that some thought that your thesis would never be substantiated, but eventually the early work that you did was validated.
Yes, well, in fact, the whole legacy of exoplanets is people working for 10 years almost in this obscurity while others told them not to bother.
Really?
really. I mean, there are many, many examples. Mine is just one small example. But what happened was, when the exoplanets were first discovered, these were crazy planets, planets almost 10 times closer to their star than Mercury is to our sun. And I actually did my PhD thesis in the mid-1990s, mid to late 90s, on what these planets would be like, so heated by the star. Unbelievable. And when I was, this involved like computer programming and applied physics. And really, countless people told me that, why am I doing this? They're probably not even real planets. And the other group of people would say, well, we're never going to observe their atmospheres anyway, so why are you doing this? Even the top universities in the country, when it came time for me to apply for faculty jobs, wouldn't hire me because they just thought the field would never take off. They thought that we would never have enough transiting planets, the ones that go in front of the star as seen from Earth, to work with. At that time, we only had one. Now Kepler has announced 1,200 of these planet candidates. But I really believed it would happen. I loved working on this. I'm a risk taker. And I just felt that it would really happen. I knew about all the people in all areas of exoplanets, you know, working for 10 years to make things happen. And there are still new people doing such. So I stuck with it. And yes, eventually it paid off, and I got to be one of the founders of Exoplanet Atmospheres.
And what do those people say to you now?
I don't know. I mean, they don't. I don't go back and, you know, push them on this, so they don't really say anything. But people are just excited about the field. I mean, there's no hard feelings. People are thrilled with how things are going. And right now we have about 36 planets where we've observed the atmospheres of those planets for get to see what kind of gases and what kind of temperatures the atmospheres might have.
Uh-huh. Scott, did we answer everything? Well, Scott's gone. Thank you, Scott. Great to hear from you. Betsy is next in River Falls. Hi, Betsy.
Hi. I have to admit that this is an audacious question because I am a philosopher and a poet, not an astronomer. But you were talking about the habitable zone, and considering the incredible extremes that we find life on our planet, are we making that maybe too small an area?
That's really a great question. A fantastic question is, are we making the habitable zone around other stars, are we considering it to be too narrow? Well, there's two answers to that. One is, on Earth, we do have life in extreme environments. Appropriate for your part of the country, the part of the country in the Midwest, the northern Midwest, is actually, you know, life can survive at minus 20 degrees Celsius. In fact, you know how in the spring you can see the snow bugs, those little black bugs on the snow? If you go outside, I mean, those are living in the snow. It's incredible. And we also have life that can live in boiling water. You can see that in Yellowstone Park. If you go there, you see boiling water, and life actually lives in there. So that is extreme on Earth. But if you take that extreme, that's actually no, maybe 140 degrees in Celsius range. It's actually not that extreme compared to all the temperatures of all the planets, even in our own solar system. So while life on Earth seems to expand in extreme range compared to what's out there in terms of other planets, it's really not that extreme. So in that sense, it's not extreme. But to answer the question in the second way is that, yes, people are very terracentric. Like, think of our atmosphere and greenhouse warming. Okay, we have a greenhouse that keeps our planet warm. We're creating more greenhouse, and that's making global warming. But what if we have another planet like Earth in the habitable zone, and it has a massive atmosphere, much more massive than Earth's? It will have a correspondingly more massive greenhouse, and in fact, it might even be too hot for life. So we do have a lot more work to really define the habitable zone and what is habitable. Our sort of easy way out is to take our solar system and make the habitable zone relatively narrow. That was a good question.
I was interested. Betsy described herself as a philosopher and a poet. I would imagine you can't do the kind of work that you're doing without having some poetry involved. Can you? I mean, just looking at that, just seeing what you found, just imagining what could be is a pretty poetic kind of thing.
Well, as a scientist, we really mostly do stick to sort of logic, computers, and discoveries, but we're hoping to inspire the nation in many different ways. And so poetry and philosophy is just one of them, and perhaps Betsy and other poets like her can actually do something with this discovery.
There you go. Betsy, write a poem about it. That would be great. And then we'll send it to everybody. That would be really nice. More phone calls in a moment. Here's our number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. And we're talking about NASA's Kepler mission has made a discovery of several hundred potential planets orbiting the Milky Way. Five of which are similar to Earth and located in the habitable zone. Our guest says, for the first time in human history, we have a pool of potentially rocky habitable zone planets. She's been involved with the Kepler mission. This is the first big step forward to answering the ancient question, how common are other Earths? This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our next call is Joe in Franklin. Hi, Joe.
Good morning. If I understood your the purpose of the 3.5-year cycle of the Kepler mission and habitable zone, you're looking for planets that mimic the Earth in size and Earth orbit and so on. And I may be mistaken or misunderstanding what you said, but couldn't a larger star or a smaller star support a habitable planet at a greater or lesser distance?
Very, very, very good comment. And by the way, I usually leave subtleties to the comment, but and, you know, because some people aren't ready for all the details, but exactly. And in fact, the announced small planets in habitable zones so far are actually around smaller stars. Because smaller stars have less energy output, and so the distance, as the caller was stating, the distance to the star is smaller for the habitable zone. And by Kepler's laws, now we're not talking about the Kepler telescope, but Johannes Kepler from hundreds of years ago, told us that it's actually based on the laws of physics, that planets closer to the star actually have shorter orbits. They move around more quickly. And so that's why it didn't take 3 years for Kepler to find the first handful of potentially habitable planet candidates.
Hmm.
So yes, smaller stars. Kepler doesn't really have any bigger stars in the field that they're following. But for the smaller ones, that's correct.
Thank you, Joe.
But I just do want to add another comment. You know, we're all we're all sort of as humans quite self-centered. So even though we can find other planets and other types of habitable zones around stars different from the sun, we're all still pretty fixated on finding that Earth analog. And the first step to finding the Earth twin is to answer the question, how common are Earth-like planets in Earth-like orbits about sun-like stars?
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Sam in Iron River. Hi, Sam.
Hi there. I'm wondering what the professor's thoughts are on the theory of the galactic habitable zone, and if she thinks that it greatly reduces the number of potential Earth-like exoplanets.
Interesting question. The galactic habitable zone is extending the idea of environments that are good for life. And people like to comment about which regions of our galaxy are suitable for life. I mean, some regions seem to have more metals that look like more rocky material than others. Some might have more cosmic rays or gamma rays that might hurt life. I personally ignore the galactic habitable zone work. It's a personal thing because we have seen just planets in every kind of environment we can imagine. And on Earth, as a previous caller pointed out, life seems to exist basically everywhere on Earth except perhaps the very, very, very driest places on Earth. And so it's just my belief that whatever nature has to offer, planets will form. And as long as the ingredients for life are there and the condition is right for life, I believe in many of those places life will form. So it's true that our galaxy has different environments, but I think planet formation and the origin of life doesn't care that much about those differences throughout our galaxy.
Thank you. Sam, unless you had something else. Sam?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have something else?
No.
Okay, great. Thank you for the call. An email from Tom in Lake Geneva. Considering that life has been found thriving in hostile environments here on Earth, what are the parameters of the Goldilocks zone? Are other forms of life considered, that is, beyond water? Carbon-based life we're all familiar with, perhaps a silica-based life form, for example?
Well, people love to consider other forms of life. But the reality that we have is the way that we're able to identify life in a distant planet is by gases in the atmosphere. So on our own Earth, for example, 20% by volume of our atmosphere is oxygen. And ozone is a byproduct of oxygen. You know, you've heard of the ozone hole.
Mm-hmm.
Well, on our Earth, oxygen is produced only by plants and other photosynthetic life, photosynthetic bacteria. So if aliens are looking at us from far away and they see that our atmosphere has so much oxygen, they'll know that's extremely fishy. And if they're smart enough, they will be able to attribute that to life. So what I'm trying to say is that we're not really looking, or as astronomers really even caring, what life is made of. We just care what life does. Life metabolizes. Life produces gases as byproducts of metabolism, and some of those gases can accumulate in the atmosphere, and we call them biosignatures. So we're focused on looking for biosignature gases in atmospheres of distant worlds. We're not able to do that yet, but we're on the path to doing that. And what that life actually is made of, whether it's carbon or silicon-based, we're not worried about that right now. We're pretty focused on our main goal.
Mm-hmm.
The second part of the question was, well, what about liquids other than water? And in fact, people are pretty excited about Titan, one of Saturn's moons, because Titan not only has an atmosphere, but it has liquid methane and ethane lakes. It's so cold on Titan, but there's a different kind of liquid. So there could be some kind of life on Titan, and people are actually working on that. But I want to wrap up this question by saying, you know, even though it is so Terra-centric to consider water as essential for all life, it's still the most common liquid in planetary systems. It's a very common, we think it will be very common. It's something, the planets that have liquid water in our liquid water habitable zone, we have been working on technology to study planets at that distance from the star. So we will be sticking with liquid water habitable zone for the near future.
Uh-huh. Joy is next in Madison. Hi, Joy.
Good morning. Maybe this is a really trivial question. I don't know. I don't really understand that much about satellites. But can I assume that this Kepler telescope just transmits raw data, the raw pictures, and all the processing and making the comparisons of the light changes is done in your lab or in the computer down here?
That's correct. Kepler transmits, I wouldn't call it pictures, but it transmits data.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a team of people in California, actually, at the NASA Ames. It's one of NASA's centers. And there's a team of probably about 15 people who have been developing computer codes and who use computer codes to take the data and kind of fix the data. It's kind of like if you take a picture and you have to do something to it in Photoshop to correct for errors.
Oh, right.
So they take the data, and then they have algorithms, computer algorithms, that correct for what we call systematics, just mm-hmm. things in the telescope that introduce some trends that need to be taken away. And then they have codes that search for the little characteristic drop in brightness as the planet goes in front of the star. So there is a little bit of things that happen on board the telescope. For example, Kepler takes data every 6 seconds, but there'd be far too much data to transmit to Earth. So most of the stars, that data gets kind of lumped together in 30-minute bins, and that is what is transmitted down. Some stars get 1-minute bins. But yes, most of the work is done here on Earth. That's correct. And actually, one more thing. Last week, the announcement accompanied a big Kepler data release. The first 4 months of data were actually made available to the public. And that means mostly you have to have some kind of training to work with it, but astronomers mm-hmm. all around the world can now look through that data themselves and do science with that data. And eventually all of Kepler data will be public.
Hmm.
Wow. I'm sorry, one last question. What is the lifespan of Kepler as a satellite?
Great question. And I have to give you a bit of background about that because it relates to Kepler's orbit. If you think of the Hubble Space Telescope, that is in what we call low Earth orbit. You know how the astronauts have visited mm-hmm. Hubble? It's about 600 kilometers above Earth, and so astronauts can get there. That environment is not suitable for Kepler. Kepler needs the darkest sky imaginable. It needs to be far from Earth. And Kepler is actually millions and millions and millions of miles from Earth. We call it an Earth trailing orbit. The Earth goes around the sun. Kepler also goes around the sun. But Kepler goes around the sun in such a way that it's drifting away from Earth. So what will probably limit Kepler's lifetime is eventually it'll drift too far from Earth that we won't be able to communicate with the telescope anymore. And I just have to think to estimate when this would be. We actually have a telescope right now, Spitzer Space Telescope. It's an infrared telescope. You can think of it as Hubble's infrared cousin, which is also in an Earth-trailing orbit. And there's about a year left before we won't be able to communicate with Spitzer, and that launched in 2003. I'm just thinking out loud here. Mm-hmm. So I guess that lasted about, that would be about 9 or 10 years. So we could estimate that Kepler might last about 10 years if NASA keeps funding it beyond the initial 3.5 years that were promised to be funded.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Joy, so much for the call. And I know you're a member of the Kepler science team. How many of you are involved in this project? Is it huge?
There's probably about 100 people on the science team.
That's all?
Well, it's kind of a lot. I mean, there's a core group of people, the original PI and co-eyes, and those people have worked on this for anywhere between 25 and 10 years. Then there's sort of a next generation like myself who weren't able to be in that core group because we simply weren't even around then, and we're actually another group. And then there's probably about 30 people in that group that I've described. the core group plus the sort of next generation group.
Mm-hmm.
We're called participating scientists.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of us, though, have students and postdocs and other people who are also in our groups. And so combined, it's probably less than 100, but I'd say about 100. But even that's not really enough. I mean, there's so much data and so much.
Oh, I imagine.
That's why the data has been given to the rest of the community to,
right.
to help out.
Yeah. Isn't it wonderful to be able to live what you dreamed of doing when you were young? That's just
great.
Actually,
because I never dreamed about that, that's a bit of a misconception. You know, I wasn't really interested in school or science or anything. I was your sort of typical social teenager. Actually, I wasn't your
really?
Typical teenager. But, yeah, I sort of didn't really pay attention in school, although astronomy was always something kind of, it would have been under the surface. And then when I was about 16, you know, I really just had to buckle down and pay attention in school and try to get good grades so I could go to college, and that's what happened. And then I became really interested in science.
All right. Thank you so much for being with us. Best of luck on all that you discover.
Thanks, Kathleen.
Thank you. Professor Sarah Seeger, Ellen Swallow Richards, Professor of Planetary Science and Professor of Physics at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. She is a member of NASA's Kepler Science Team. Bill Nye, the science guy, is going to be joining us the last part of our program here. He's an engineer and a comedian and author, educator, and inventor. He is vice president of the Planetary Society, and he has been an Emmy Award-winning television writer, producer, and host. We'll be continuing to take phone calls as we talk about this Kepler mission and what they have discovered and released to the public. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and our email address, we have a couple of those we have yet to get to, is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. NASA's Kepler mission made a discovery of several hundred potential planets orbiting the Milky Way. Five of them are similar to Earth, and they are located in the habitable zone. In one generation, NASA Chief Charles Bolden said last week, we have gone from extraterrestrial planets being a mainstay of science fiction to the present. And it's helped turn science fiction into today's reality. These discoveries underscore the importance of NASA's science missions, which consistently increase understanding of our place in the cosmos. These are potential planets in the habitable zone, meaning liquid water can exist on their surfaces. And they're called candidates because they do require, as our last guest was saying, follow-up observations to verify that they are actually planets. The Kepler mission has already uncovered 1,235 star-orbiting potential planets. Out of the 54 new planets Kepler has found in the habitable zone, just five are Earth-sized. And Bill Nye, the science guy, will be with us for the remainder of this hour, and we'll be welcoming phone calls for him at 800-486-8655 is our number. Hello, Bill.
Oh, good morning. Good
Hi.
Morning. Is it still morning in Wisconsin?
Yeah, where are you?
I'm in Studio City, California.
Oh.
Los Angeles. I'm
oh.
Los Angeles.
Studio City, California. Well,
Studio City's part of Los Angeles.
Well, we're in Wisconsin where the Green Bay Packers won the football game yesterday.
You know, I did not
football
hear anything about
yesterday.
Their game yesterday.
Yeah, there was.
I thought the season was on. No, I'm kidding. Go Packers. Let the record show I predicted the Packers would win.
You did, huh?
On big plays.
You did.
That's the weakness or the feature, I think, of the Bears. The Steelers.
Uh-huh.
Is you can kind of see it coming.
Huh.
And so if you can anticipate well enough, sure enough, the Packers did. But it wasn't like a blowout.
No, it was a little tense
much.
For a while.
It was tense. Game.
It was very exciting.
I mean, as a fan, I was very happy to have an exciting game.
Yeah, yeah, it was good. All right, well, you put out a big thank you to the Kepler team last week saying
that was cool.
It was cool, huh?
You designed this crazy instrument.
Right.
And you put it in this crazy orbit. And it worked.
And it worked.
It's very exciting. It's from an engineering standpoint and from a science standpoint, it's a wonderful thing. You know, it has the Earth's orbit around the sun, 365 and a quarter days. Well, this thing is 371 days.
Huh.
So it falls a little behind the Earth every time around. but this is worked out just so.
Wow.
You can look at this group of stars. It's very just fantastic. It's just fantastic.
Yeah. Is there a possibility of all the components? Is it a real elaborate Kepler telescope so that there are all kinds of parts and anything could go wrong with any number of parts, or is it fairly simple?
Spacecraft in orbit and Earth trailing orbit with cameras that can transmit millions of pixels of information on this patch of sky the size of a grain of salt at arm's length. That's easy.
I thought so, right.
Yeah. No, it can be done. And
yeah, it's remarkable.
I always talk about this is a really worthy use of our wealth and intellect of a society to explore the cosmos just for the sake of exploring it.
Yeah. But it goes beyond that. Tell me a little bit more what you meant when you said that knowing that there are other worlds that could support life changes, that could support life, changes how we view our own. How does it change how we view our own?
Well, let's go historically. To find out that the Earth is not the center of the solar system, I claim changes your life. To find out that, wait, the sun is not the center of everything.
Mm.
Changes your life.
Mm-hmm.
And then, your planet is hardly unique.
Mm-hmm.
It's just another planet around a run-of-the-mill star among billions of stars. And wait, there's more. You're in a galaxy that's just nothing special. It's just another galaxy among billions of galaxies. Mm. I mean, that's really humbling. On the other hand, that we can figure it out is
right.
Wonderful.
It is wonderful.
I mean, I don't want to be bragging on myself as a human, but compared to how badly we could be doing, it's pretty good.
Yeah.
And then also in the higher, bigger picture of things, for me, you get a real appreciation for the Earth by studying other planets. I'll tell you, my fellow Earthlings, we do not want to be Venus. Venus would be very bad for us. We are not suited to Venus. And if we don't do something, we'll go a little Venusian here, which will be hard on everybody.
If we don't do something about the warming of our planet?
About climate change, yeah.
Yeah.
And I know there's many, many people, I'm sure your listeners are skeptical of climate change. And I encourage you to do what I did. Go to the Ice Core Lab in Glendale, Colorado, and look at the evidence that comes out of the ice and see if it doesn't shake you up a little bit.
Yeah. And talk to people who have been there, to the poles. They're noticing it.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's true. You can look at satellite pictures. Speaking of space exploration, using the same technology that you use to put a telescope in orbit around the sun, you can put instruments in orbit around the Earth and see that the ice at the North Pole especially is shrinking.
Yeah.
The Earth's North Pole. And this is not good for anybody.
No.
But understanding all this comes from space exploration and a decision or set of decisions by a society that this is a worthy thing to do. This is cool. This is good. And so it's exciting. I mean, so you understand they found evidence or reasonable indication that there's over 1,200 planets in this tiny patch of sky.
Yeah, it's just a little part of the sky.
This tiny patch. Just think how many there are everywhere. As Carl Sagan, my old professor and the guy who founded the Planetary Society, said, he talked about soon we will discover many, many worlds.
Mm.
And he was absolutely right. As our technology and our techniques have improved over the last couple decades, we have indeed found thousands of distant planets, and you cannot help but wonder, is there somebody out there
right.
wondering the same about us? You
right.
just can't help it.
Well, no, you can't help it, and you wish that we would know pretty soon, because I'd like to see it happen. I don't know about you, but I bet you really would like to see it happen.
What, get in touch with somebody on another
sure.
world? It doesn't seem very likely, but you have to pursue it. That's what I always say. As unlikely as it is that we would emerge at the same time as another civilization, and then happened to have sent a message a few thousand years ago, so it showed up now, it's very unlikely. However, it's hardly impossible. So you just can't help it. You just got it.
Right.
Got to try it.
Yeah. Bill Nye, the science guy, is with us. We'll take phone calls for him in a moment on the Ideas Network. All right, let's go to the phones for Bill Nye, the Science Guy. Ian from Lansing, Iowa. Hi.
Hello. It's great to talk to you, Mr. Nye.
Good morning. It's still morning? Sure it is.
Yeah.
It was your TV show that changed my life with a scale model of the solar system in a soccer field.
Oh, great. That's good. Oh, that's great. That was an indoor soccer stadium, and it was charming. It was really good. I mean, I'm proud of it. It came out well. Thank you.
My question is, we know these plants are in a Goldilocks zone. Is there a plan on what we're going to do next to learn more about them?
Well, the plan is to build the next instrument, which is controversial right now. It's the James Webb Space Telescope. And then we have this thing, the Terrestrial Planet Finder, the TPF. And these new spacecraft would look deeper and closer, and they'd be tuned to look for signs of methane, natural gas, swamp gas, if you will, and water. Everybody's all hot for water vapor, because that would indicate if you could get liquid water, man, everybody thinks the chances of some kind of living thing are very high. So more tax dollars will be thrown at the problem, we all hope. Oh, listen to me. No, but it's we are living at the most exciting time in space exploration.
Thank you, Ian.
It's really something.
Yeah, it is something. Dan and Viola, hi.
Oh, good morning. I'm one of the people that isn't a skeptic about global warming. And these planets that we're discovering that are so far away that could be habitable or life, could sustain life. They're thousands of light years away. It's not conceivable that we'll ever reach these stars. And so why aren't we directing our resources to the more pressing, urgent questions that we need to solve here on the planet to save the planet before we start venturing out into other venues of the universe?
This is a great question, a time-honored question. So let me put it to you this way, a couple ways. First of all, if you get to be a politician, maybe you are a politician.
No.
And the question becomes, should we build the new baseball stadium, or should we pay teachers' salaries or policemen's salaries? I hope you get the right answer. You should pay teachers' salaries, right? But what if it's this? What if you should pay teacher salaries or an after-school program? Then it's not so clear, right? But is it teacher salaries, after-school program, and new baseball stadium? It's not a baseball stadium. It's a community center. Well, the trouble for a politician is you have to do all at once. You have to get them all done. That's the challenge. Now, is your life enriched by having had people walk on the moon? My claim is yes, it is. Your life is better knowing that the sun is the center of the solar system instead of the earth, for example. And so this exploration enriches our lives, and I claim the exploration of other worlds especially raises our awareness of climate change. So the amount of money spent on these things is so small compared to the amount of the resources that we're going to need to resolve climate change, that it is well worth it. That's a great question, though. Oh, that's a good question.
Thank you, Dan, for the call. Here's an email from Tom. If a sun exoplanet is detected by Kepler or other devices 500 to 2,000 light years away, can we be sure these bodies still exist, or are we looking at extinct suns, stars, planets from the distant past?
This is another great question. Oh, this is just a great question. So, first of all, when you get on the scale of a few thousand years, there's no question that the sun's still there. The star is still there. You have to get into the billions where that goes wrong. But neither here nor there. Another great thing I always like to ask is, let's say the civilization came and went on this distant planet. Well, it doesn't come and go here until the light gets here. And this gets into a big question, you know. Well, the spacecraft has already landed. It's just we have to wait the 7 minutes for a radio signal to get from Mars to the Earth. We have to wait the 1,000 years for the light to get from the star to here. You're asking a question that is meaningful to us in everyday time. But in a relativistic sense, you can't, the event on this distant world doesn't happen here until the light gets here. And so then you say you can do two things. Well, there's no point in ever looking because we'll never know. Or let's soak up all the light we can and see what happened.
Mm-hmm.
That's another just great question. And, you know, every time you go to write a science fiction story, this becomes trouble. You know, can you go back in time and kill yourself?
Right, right.
Or what have you.
Right. Yeah. Have you done science fiction writing?
Not seriously since high school. You know, I had a lot of Twilight Zone ideas, but no, I haven't.
That's insane.
My thing is to write the screenplay, which, you know, where I live here in Los Angeles, I live like totally in the valley. That's like where I live.
Like, and wow.
If you don't have a screenplay, you get a ticket. You have to come to your door and make sure you have a screenplay. But that's about a historical figure who became a self-taught mathematician. It's very cool. To me, it's very cool. But neither here nor there. The space exploration enriches our lives, and everybody who got excited about space exploration, in general, with a tiny trace percentage, loves science fiction, fascinated with science fiction.
Yeah.
So science fiction's, the good science fiction is the result of science, and we all are troubled by the two great questions: where did we come from, and are we alone?
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as you start looking at those two questions, you wonder about other worlds on other star systems and so on.
Hmm. Well, I want to know where we're going to after we die.
Well, there's always debate about that.
Right, yeah. Jeff in Flambeau Flowage. Hi, Jeff. Hello, Jeff.
Jeff.
Oh, I'm sorry, Jeff. You're not there. Kate in Prairie Farm. Hi, Kate.
Hi there. You sort of answered my question a little bit about time, but it seems like we're kind of on the cosmic geologic time scale. We're kind of a blip. And because there was sort of a Big Bang, do we think that all these planets are kind of in a similar timeline, or could we be looking at planets that in a million years there will be life on them? I love thinking about time. It's kind of mind-boggling, and I'm wondering how you take that into account looking at these planets.
Well, that's what you have to do, is try to know your place in space. Try to know your place relative to the Big Bang. So people look at as far as they can back in time, and they look at the shift of the light coming from recognizable stars. And it is quite reasonable that we all emerged at about the same time. Quite reasonable that at least a few of these few thousand planets came to be about the same time we did. And so maybe a few of them have organisms on them, not unlike us, wondering about their place in space. No, this whole thing of when a planet comes into existence and how long it takes for cosmic dust to come together, it's wonderful. I mean, you can make all kinds of wonderful and clearly scientifically reasonable assumptions, but to really know what those other planets are doing is a tricky question. It's wonderful to think about, isn't it? And so this thing called deep time is just really hard for all of us. And if you meet somebody who says, "Oh, I have no trouble imagining 4 billion years," I just think that person is... he's lying.
I want to meet that person.
Yeah, you just really can't imagine what a billion years is. It's just, whoa.
Right, right.
It's so long. You know, humans come along, we're just blip, blip, and we're gone.
Yeah.
Even the best humans, you know, people that break a century, they don't see much of deep time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Kate.
Thank you.
Now, Jeff has called back. I hope we have time for him. We only have a minute, everybody.
A minute. Don't blow it, Bill.
Yeah. All right. Hi, hey. Jeff. Go ahead.
Yeah. My question for your guest is more philosophical.
Okay.
You know, in regards to the human race, our place on the planet and in the cosmos, and because the world economy right now is capitalism, economy, jobs, do we really have a right morally to go to another planet? The last planet we went to, we killed and enslaved enslave their indigenous people. We clear-cut and burn their forests. We mine and flatten their mountaintops and polluted their streams. We fought wars over land rights. And we exploited their wildlife, creating threatened, endangered, and extinct species. Do we have the right to go to another planet? And can we trust ourselves? Are we an immoral beast?
Woo! Bill.
So by when you say go to another planet, do you mean Mars?
No, if we found another Earth-type planet.
Oh, well, we can't get there. We don't have, right now, nobody knows of any way to get there. I would love to cross that bridge when we come to it, but do you see, everybody, that discovering these planets makes him ask these questions.
Right.
Do we inherently suck as a species? Which is a pretty good question. And so you ask it because you discover these other worlds. That is the passion, beauty, and joy, the PB&J of the Kepler.
And on that note, we have to say goodbye.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning to you, Bill.
Packers, way to go.
They went. They did it. Yeah, thank you. Goodbye. Bill Nye, science guy, our guest this part of the program, commenting on these remarkable findings from the Kepler mission. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, Chrissy Pease for on-air production here in Milwaukee, and thanks for all of your calls. Until tomorrow.